and parents were allowed to send a few times each deployment. Beyond that, the men's existence was charted out in a rhythm that amounted to 6 hours of watch, followed by 12 hours of equipment repair, endless paperwork, and qualifying exams. Nobody was handed his dolphins, the mark of an official submariner, until he had qualified on nearly every system on the boat. Still, sanity finds a way, and on this sub, Mac was determined to help it. Mac had managed to dig up about a dozen guitar players among his hand-picked crew, and now they played in nightly sing-alongs. Tommy Cox was among them, back on board carrying his guitar and a 3-month supply of strings and picks. Cox, who had become one of the first spooks to bother with all of the standard submariners' qualifying exams and earn his dolphins, now entertained his true crewmates with performances of Torpedo in the Water and a new song about Scorpion, as well as standard covers of Johnny Cash, Ricky Nelson, Jerry Lee Lewis, and Elvis Presley tunes. It was no accident that Cox was back on Lapon. While most spooks were assigned to subs by the Naval Security Group and almost never rowed the same boat twice, Mac had managed to hand-pick his spook team, just like he had the rest of his crew. He fought to keep his favorites, his core team, together. Along with Cox, there was Lieutenant Donald R. Fallon, the spook team leader. Mac decided Fallon would be a permanent member of the crew about 10 seconds after the spook first boarded Lapon. He had spent his first 9 seconds staring Mac down. The 10th second was the kicker. That's when he came up with a description of Mac that was never topped. Borrowing from the sub-force's love of acronyms, he dubbed Mac Nomfwick, or, in non-naval parlance, Number One Motherfucker What's in Charge. Mac liked men who were bright, inventive, just odd enough to appreciate his own eccentricities, and as willing as he was to bend the rules. One of Mac's favorite acquisitions was a chief machinist's mate with the unlikely name of Donald Duck. He was a self-proclaimed hillbilly, raised in a log house in Shelby County, Alabama. Mechanics was the family business. Duck's dad worked on buses, Duck on submarines. He never finished grade school. In fact, he had enlisted in the Navy under an illiteracy program. But he could fix anything on Lapon, and he was an even better scrounger than Mac. That, in particular, was an especially useful art, now that the Vietnam War made materials scarce. Duck would find or steal whatever Lapon needed, keeping his cache of spare parts in a place only he believed to be secret. Duck's lack of formal schooling didn't matter on Lapon, where most of the enlisted men had little more than a high school education anyway. This was a blue-collar crowd, but they were, as a whole, a bit brighter, a bit more inventive, and a lot more willing to put up with long months of confinement than just about anyone in the regular Navy. The officers mostly came out of the Naval Academy. In the end, the differences blurred. Rank, station, pedigree. On the best subs, none of that mattered much. Maybe it was the confinement. Maybe there was no other good way to run a submarine. After all, one of the first lessons any college-educated lieutenant learned was that he wasn't going to get very far without the help of his grizzled chiefs and a bunch of enlisted guys willing to engineer imaginative fixes to all of the unimaginable problems that were likely to crop up month after month at sea. Now the crew that Mac built was about to be put to the test. 1 week into the trip, Lapon got a message, the one Mac had been hoping for. On September 16th, SOSUS had detected a Yankee north of Norway. It was heading out of the Barents Sea toward the GIUK gap. A second SOSUS array then picked up the Yankee as it passed just north of Norway's Jan Mayen Island at the mouth of the Denmark Strait, which separates Greenland from Iceland. If Mac could intercept the Yankee before it made it past the gap into the open ocean, where she would be far more difficult to find, Lapon would be able to attempt a trail. Whenever Lapon dared come to periscope depth, his crew would also get a glimpse of the waters they hunted. The periscope television, Paraviz, was finally working. As Mac raced Lapon toward the Denmark Strait, an Allied P-3 Orion airborne submarine hunter confirmed the Yankees' heading. Lapon arrived the next day and began a patrol, moving slowly back and forth at the southernmost tip of the Denmark Strait, just southwest of Iceland. Donny Ray Bolling, the chief of the boat, hung a map in the crew's mess. From now on, the quartermaster would go below periodically to give the crew a look at Lapon's position. If they caught up to the Yankee, he'd chart her position as well. Sharing such details with the crew was against regulation, but Mac wanted his men enthusiastic. He believed that knowing what they were attempting would make up for the lack of sleep that was about to become the rule on the boat. Mac called for modified battle stations. Around him, the control room was packed with men, crammed in between charting tables, computer equipment, and weapon controls, with all their corresponding oscilloscopes, dials, gauges, and plotting gear. The pipes that hung from nearly every inch overhead and all around made the compartment seem all the more crowded. In the center of it all was the periscope stand. Two scopes sprouted out of the foot-high pedestal. Just in front of the stand, the diving officer and two planesmen sat tightly tiered in a pyramid, staring at depth gauges. From here on out, the fire control party, the sonar crews, the navigators, and the diving watch would have two imperatives: finding the Yankee and keeping the Yankee from finding the Lapon. Only one day went by before the Yankee passed to the east of Lapon. The sound of the submarine was so faint that the sonar men almost failed to pick it up over the clamor of nearby fishing trawlers and teeming marine life. But there it was, a slight flicker on the oscilloscope, the electronic image of the Soviet submarine. This wasn't going to be easy. In the noisy waters off of Greenland, the submarine was audible in the din only when it ventured within 1,400 yards of Lapon. Mac ordered Lapon southeast. He was going to try a sprint and drift. The plan was to race Lapon at 20 knots for half an hour or so to a point where the Yankee would soon pass if she maintained her track. Then Lapon would slow down to 3 to 5 knots, drift back and forth, and listen. The Yankee showed up, but then disappeared again. Mac was worried. The Soviets weren't keeping to their expected course. Each time the sounds from the Yankee came through, they were lost almost immediately, drowned out by the living Atlantic, made even louder now by violent currents caused by a raging storm above. Mac paced about the control room, frustrated at having to crawl blindly around the ocean, knowing that the Yankee was so close. Lapon found and lost the Yankee several times over the next few days. Then on the fourth day, the Yankee showed up again. This time Lapon followed, first for an hour, then for two, then for three. The Yankee's propellers spun a steady rhythm through the sonar team's headsets. 6 hours, 12 hours, the Yankee was still on a steady course in front of Lapon. But at 18 hours, the Yankee disappeared from the sonar screens, lost again. Mac's burgeoning underwater drama had fallen flat. By now, most of the officers and some of the crew had gone several days with little sleep. Mac had only dozed, minutes at a time, mostly while still standing in the control room. And now, for these men, grave disappointment replaced the adrenaline rush that had already sustained itself far too long. No one spoke the obvious. No one wanted to say that maybe it was impossible to keep track of this new, quieter generation of Soviet submarine as it rode through the cacophonous ocean. No one wanted to give up. Sharing Mac's disappointment back in Norfolk and in Washington, D.C., were Captain Bradley, Vice Admiral Arnold Shade, who was still commander of submarines in the Atlantic, and Admiral Moore, the CNO. They had been in constant touch as Mac flashed UHF progress messages to U.S. aircraft flying overhead. The Navy, in turn, kept aides to the President up to date. Nixon was following the trail in real time. The admirals ordered all SOSUS installations in the area to listen for the Yankee. P-3 Orions also were on the lookout. But in both instances, the efforts were futile. Mac decided to take a huge gamble. Calling his navigators and officers into the wardroom, he announced that they were going to give up trying to pick up the Yankee near the Denmark Strait. Instead, Mac was going to try to guess where the Yankee was headed next, and he wanted to try to beat her to her destination. Now, Mac, his XO Charles H. Burkell Jr., the engineer officer Ralph L. Tyndall, and others, bent over charts and began an intense game of what if, putting themselves in the place of the Yankees' commander. Desperation weighed in as much as logic when they finally decided to attempt to pick up the Yankees' track several hundred miles south, near Portugal's Azores Islands. Lepan hurried down there and then trolled about the appointed spot for 3 days. Too much time, Mac fretted. He made another guess and moved the sub west. Almost as soon as Lepan settled into her new patrol, her hull began to reverberate with the grinding of metal on metal. Mac came running into the control room. The diving officer reported that Lepan was losing depth. The 4,800-ton Lepan had been caught in the net of a deep-sea fishing trawler, tangled in the net's metal weights and thick metal cable. The Yankee could pass by at any moment, and Lepan was dangling along with Sunday brunch. It didn't take long for the fishermen to give up, or maybe they cut their net. Either way, they left the area with the greatest one-that-got-away story of their lives. But a piece of the trawler's cable had worked its way around a sonar device on the front of the submarine. There was no way Lepan could effect a silent trail with the dangling cable clicking across her bow. Mac had no choice. He waited for dark, then ordered Lepan to the surface. Now, praying that the Yankee would not pass, at least not now, he sent a man out onto the sail with a large pair of bolt cutters. His gamble worked. The cable was away, and Lepan was ready, when the Yankee showed up 12 hours later. This time Mac was determined not to lose the Soviet submarine. This more southern portion of the Atlantic wasn't as loud as the waters off Greenland, but the Yankee was still quieter than any submarine a U.S. boat had ever tried to follow. It was time for a new tactic that Mac dubbed on the spot, the close-in trail. Lepan would tailgate the Yankee, moving no farther than 3,000 yards away. More than 4,000 or 5,000 yards away, and the Yankee would be lost. Mac's strategy was risky. Hurtling 4,800 tons that close to the massive Yankee was dangerous. Normally, even surface ships try to stay about 2 miles apart for fear of collision. And Lepan had the added worry of detection. Mac just hoped that this new submarine didn't have better sonar than her predecessors. Lepan was so close that all someone had to do was drop a piece of equipment or slam a watertight door at the wrong time, and even the Soviets' outdated equipment could register an American shadow. Just about everyone on board realized the risk they were taking, but nobody dared question Mac. Nobody had time to. It had become crucial now to figure out what the Soviet vessel sounded like when she slowed down or turned. until Lapon's sonar team could figure out what combination of clicks or tones matched which maneuvers. Both submarines were in grave danger of colliding. Mac ordered Lapon to slip, side to side, behind the Yankee, as his men set about finding answers to a matrix of questions. Once again, Mac engaged himself in a game of what-if, trying to put himself in the Soviet captain's place, wondering what he would do and when. It was like working on a very large, very difficult crossword puzzle. One answer led to others. One blank created several avenues of confusion. All Lapon's crew could do was keep collecting information. The sonar teams began listening for any flaws in the Yankees' construction, anything that would give them clues to help them see the other submarine as it maneuvered. Standard sonar would never have been enough. The Yankee was simply too quiet. But Lapon wasn't relying on just standard sonar. Mac had slipped aboard an added edge, an experimental sonar device designed to capitalize on some discoveries that Kellen's USS Ray had made in 1967 and 1968, when she trailed the November-class attack sub into the Mediterranean, and then tracked a Charlie in the North Atlantic. The device worked by upgrading the way the standard system registered noise levels in the ocean. It zeroed in on certain tones, those made by the Yankee as she moved through the water, almost the way notes of music sound from a bottle when somebody blows over the top. After a fair amount of trial and error, Lapon's crew realized that one particular frequency changed each time the Yankee turned. A shift to the left, and the tone was slightly higher. When the Yankee moved away, the tone lowered. If the tone changed quickly, it meant the Yankee was making a swift course change. The one place Lapon couldn't follow from was directly behind. Unlike other Soviet submarines that offered an easy-to-follow din from their propellers, the Yankee was quiet enough from behind that she was rendered effectively invisible. Indeed, the Yankee might have been able to slip away entirely, even with Lapon's extra sonar gadget, if not for what must have been a structural flaw. To the left, the Yankee's machinery was making more noise than any other portion of the boat. From now on, Lapon was going to follow that machinery noise. If it got louder, Mac would know that the Yankee had made a left turn. If the Yankee seemed to vanish, she probably had turned right. Ultimately, the best vantage point turned out to be a little off to the side of the Yankee's stern, in either direction, with the left side being a little louder. From there, the new sonar device picked up strong tones, and standard sonar registered steam noises coming from the Yankee's turbines, and the clicks made by the Yankee's propeller each time it made a revolution. Counting those clicks and logging turn counts was how Mac and his crew determined the Yankee's speed. All this took 4 or 5 days to figure out, longer than the entire length of most trailings attempted so far against the noisy Soviet Hotel, Echo, and November subs, the Hens. But Mac wasn't going to break off. Instead, he was going to keep following, and he would figure out the mechanics as he went along. The process of trial and error spanned several watch stations, leaving it up to Mac and his engineer officer to teach each succeeding team what had been discovered over the past 12 hours. Mac was determined not to lose the Yankee again, especially when he realized that she was headed on a track toward the U.S. Atlantic coast. He again began to forego sleep, although he slipped in 15-minute catnaps at the helm, a trick he picked up in college from an article in Reader's Digest. Days later, Lapon was still tracking the Yankee. Mac began to map out the Yankee's operating area, one of the most crucial pieces of intelligence he could carry home. The Soviets had settled into a holding pattern that covered about 200,000 square miles. They moved back and forth staying between 1,500 and 2,000 miles off the United States. Up until now, the Navy had been convinced that the Soviet Union would send its Yankees as close as 700 miles from U.S. shores. But Mack's discovery would help naval intelligence determine that the Yankees' new SSN-6 missiles actually had a range of 1,200 to 1,300 miles. If Lapon had not followed the Yankee this far, it would have been difficult for the United States to keep track of the new Soviet nuclear threat, even though the Yankee plowed through what appeared to be a well-defined box. The United States would have been searching 800 miles too close to shore. Now Mack mapped the Yankee's exact course. Choosing one area, she meandered at about 6 knots before racing to another area at 12 to 16 knots. Then she slowed again. Every 90 minutes, almost to the second, the Yankee changed course, sometimes by 60 degrees, sometimes by far more. A few times a day, the Yankee went to communications depth, presumably to receive radio messages. And every night, at the stroke of midnight, she rose to periscope depth to ventilate. Between 10 and 16 times a day, she turned completely around to clear her baffles, listening to see whether anyone was following. Each time the Yankee turned, Lapon turned with her, trying to stay behind, just off to one side, shielded in the backwash of the Yankee's own noise. U.S. submariners also clear their baffles regularly when they are out on operations, only never according to schedule. The delicate question of timing those maneuvers was left to a pair of dice kept in the Lapon's control room for just that purpose. Once a day, the Yankee kicked out with a wild, high-speed move that Lapon's crew called the Yankee Doodle, because it resembled the twisted designs on someone's desktop notepad. The Yankee would curl about, usually in a figure eight or some version of that, ending up facing 180 degrees from where she had started. Shifting to port, she would then make a 180-degree turn, then a second 180-degree turn, then a 90-degree turn, then a 270-degree turn, and end with two more 90-degree turns. The first set of turns seemed designed to catch an intruder following close in, and the second to catch another submarine following from farther away. All this was usually done at high speed, sometimes twice, back-to-back. The entire process took about an hour. Had the Yankees' sonar been any better, the maneuver might have been effective. But the Soviets seemed to have made one key miscalculation. Lapon could hear the turns and get out of the way long before the Soviets could hear Lapon. In fact, Lapon's sonar techs realized that their sonar seemed to have more than twice the range of Soviet sonar. In good conditions, Lapon could spot a surface ship from 20,000 yards away. But the Yankee would pass within 10,000 yards of the same ship before showing any reaction. As Lapon's trail fell into a routine, Mack was finally able to give up his standing catnaps. He actually went back to his stateroom to lie down and sleep, though never longer than 90 minutes. He never missed a course change or a Yankee doodle. It was during one of his naps, however, that Mack made the biggest mistake of the mission. Perhaps the biggest mistake of his career. The mess cook awakened Mack on the advice of a junior officer who decided Mack would rather give up sleep than his nightly order of blueberry muffins. Startled, Mack let out a roar. The cook went running, and the muffins and coffee went flying. In that one moment, Mack had destroyed possibly the best perk ever offered a submarine captain. His beloved fresh blueberry muffins, split and drenched with butter. Nobody would again dare delivery. Not then. Not as the third week of the trail gave way to a fourth, and then an unheard-of fifth week. By that time, Lapon's three rotating officers of the deck realized they had each fallen into sync with their Soviet counterparts. Indeed, each American could identify his Soviet partner by slight stylistic differences in the Yankee doodles and other course changes. They named these Soviets. Terrible Terrence and Wild Willie were the two most memorable, and they began to take bets on how well they could predict the Yankees' next move. Tyndall won most often. The sonar crew also got into the act, interpreting the sounds they picked up from inside the Yankee. Sounds of drilling, pumps running, and other noise led to some crude jokes, mostly bathroom humor. A quick clank was automatically recorded as a toilet lid being slammed, and every time Lapond sonar men heard the rushing of air over their headphones that could have been sanitary tanks being blown, they reported quite formally, "Con, sonar, we just got shit on." Every man in the crew, down to the youngest seaman and the lowliest mess cook, was getting into the act. Mac let each of them take a turn at manually plotting the unfolding course. It was heady stuff for the young crewmen. Here they were, on a trail longer than any other, trailing one of the most crucial pieces of hardware the Soviets had put to sea, and they were integrally involved in the process. The excitement was extending from sub to shore. Mac had gotten to know the Yankee captain's habits well enough to be able to predict when the Soviets would go deep, and to use those moments to bring Lapond to periscope depth and flash a quick message to the P-3 Orions that were flying high over the Yankees' patrol area. All continued to go well until one of the Orions almost ended the entire effort. The pilot must have come lower than he should have, because when the Yankee came to periscope depth, her crew spotted the plane and made an immediate dive. The Orion sped away. The men on Lapond listened to the entire drama, their sub undetected. They realized that although the Orion had been spotted, the Soviets didn't seem to know that they were being trailed through water as well as air. That seemed true, in fact, until someone back in Washington made a big mistake. Rumors in the sub-force say it was an admiral in naval aviation who leaked information to a newspaper that could threaten the mission. The leak didn't specify that Lapon was out following a Yankee, and it didn't even say that a Soviet ballistic missile submarine was, at that very moment, wandering 1,500 to 2,000 nautical miles off the United States. But on October 9, 1969, the New York Times ran a front-page story headlined, "New Soviet Subs Noisier Than Expected." Whoever leaked the story was either unaware of Lapond's findings or distorted them, because what the Times reported was far more reassuring than the truth. As Mac had found out, the Yankees were by far the quietest subs the Soviets had put to sea, although U.S. subs were still quieter. Word of the story must have made it back to the Soviet Navy and to the Yankees' captain. Either that, or he had become suddenly psychic. Within hours of the story's publication, moments after the Yankee made its midnight trip to communications depth, she broke all of her patterns. In fact, she went wild. The Yankee made a sudden 180-degree turn and came roaring back down her former path, full out, at 20 knots, heading almost straight for Lapon. This did not at all resemble the calculated set of turns that made up the Yankee Doodle, nor did it have the calm routine of the Yankee's usual slow turns, those baffle-clearing maneuvers. This was a desperation ploy, an all-out search by the Soviets to see if they were being followed. This was the ultimate game of chicken. This was what the U.S. sub-force called a Crazy Ivan. The Yankee came flying through the water, her image filling the screens in Lapon's control room and the noise of her flight screaming through sonar men's headsets. It sounded like a freight train running through a tunnel. Kerchukka, kerchukka, kerchukka. "That bastard is coming down," someone in the control room blurted out. The men tensed although they knew Lapon was still 300 feet below the Yankee as she blindly passed to starboard. Nobody missed the irony that the Yankee, in her noisy high-speed flight, had missed her chance to detect Lapon. The Yankee continued to search, moving in circles for hours, but Mac countered with his own evasive maneuvers, enacted by a crew who had been standing at battle stations throughout the drama. Mac refused to break off the chase. Instead, he waited for the Yankee to calm down. Then he continued the mission. On October 13th, nearly a month after the trail began, Admiral Shade sent a top-secret message to the Lapon. Admiral Moore states that SecDef and all in Washington watching operation with special interest, and notes with great pleasure and pride superb performance of all participants. I share his thoughts. Lapon continued on through the rest of the Yankees' patrol, and then some, as the Soviets took an almost straight track back home. There were no more Yankee doodles, no more crazy Ivans. The Yankee beat a path to the GI-UK gap, where Lapon left her on November 9th. Lapon had followed the Yankee for an amazing 47 days. Tommy Cox again was moved to write, this time coming up with The Ballad of Whitey Mack. Whitey's got the deck and the con. Now he had quite a job to do, and every man on board knew when the going got rough in this game of blind man's bluff, somehow he'd pull her through. Cox's lyrics were right on target. It really was blind man's bluff, a game far more dangerous than mere hide-and-spy operations. Mack's success marked the beginning of a new mission for the submarine force. From here on out, the fleet would be focused on trailing Soviet ballistic missile submarines at sea. U.S. attack submarines were suddenly elevated to critical participants in the nation's strategic nuclear defense, and they would lead the greatest sea hunt in maritime history. For now, as he drove Lapon back to Norfolk, Mack was basking in the glory that was finally his. Messages of congratulations flooded the radio channels. Months later, Lapon would receive the highest award ever given to submarines, the Presidential Unit Citation. Whitey Mack would win a Distinguished Service Medal, the highest personal honor the Navy awarded its officers in peacetime. Mack was told by an admiral that his men would get their presidential thank you, PUC certificates and ribbons, in a ceremony as secret as their mission. Wives and children cordially not invited. In answer, Mack kindly informed the admiral what he could do with his PUC. As far as Mack was concerned, there would be no award and no ceremony unless the men's families could be there. He stood his ground, and in the end, the awards were made in the steel bowels of a Navy ship, families present, without a single word spoken about how or why the men had earned awards signed by the president. But it was one of the messages sent out when Lapon was still on her way home that pleased Mack more than any other accolade. It wasn't addressed to Mack or to his crew. Instead, the message was sent out to every other submarine out on operations in the Atlantic. Get out of the way. Whitey's coming through. The order was clear. Everyone was to make way and give the Lapon a clear track home. When Mack heard that, he slapped his fist in his hand, shook his head, and said, "Eat your heart out, suckers. Whitey's coming through." Chapter 7. Here She Comes. Whitey Mack had set the new standard, one that other commanders were itching to match. Indeed, itching to beat. Trailing Soviet missile subs was fast becoming the Navy's most critical mission, though not all of the men leading these dangerous hunts were as skilled as Mack, or as lucky. At least two subs put the United States on the verge of nuclear alert when they radioed that the Yankees they were following had opened their missile doors and seemed ready to launch. In both cases, the U.S. subs quickly radioed again to say that the Soviets were engaged in simple drills. Within months of Lepon's feat, there were also several collisions between American subs and Soviet subs, accidents that threatened U.S.-Soviet moves toward détente. When the USS Gato, SSN 615, slammed into an old Soviet hotel-class missile sub in November 1969, Sergei Georgievich Gershkov, the longtime commander-in-chief of the Soviet Navy, sent warships into the Barents in search of the intruder. He was hoping to find proof that Gato had been sunk. Gershkov wasn't a bloodthirsty man, but the collision came just 2 days before arms control talks were scheduled to begin in Helsinki, Finland. It stunned him that President Richard Nixon and his national security adviser, Henry Kissinger, could proffer arms negotiations as though they were simple handshakes, while letting their submarines invade Soviet waters. Evidence of Gato's steel corpse would have given Gershkov one knockout of a handshake to proffer back. But his forces never did find Gato, which had hightailed it out of there, weapons armed and ready. At the orders of the Atlantic Fleet commanders, Gato's captain prepared false mission reports showing that his boat had broken off her patrol 2 days before the accident. Close calls, especially those that stopped short of major incident, were almost always omitted when Navy intelligence officers went to brief Nixon and his aides. Thus, there was no pressure on the submarine force to curtail its brazen operations, even after two more minor collisions in 1970, one in the Barents and one in the Mediterranean. There was, however, a third accident that year, one that was so violent and so severe that the Navy had no choice but to immediately tell top Pentagon officials and Nixon. It happened in late June. The USS Tautog, SSN 639, was heading for waters filled with Soviet traffic outside of Petropavlovsk, the big missile sub-base on the Kamchatka Peninsula in the northern Pacific. Little rattled Tautog's 39-year-old captain, Commander Buell G. Balderston, who had already overcome childhood rheumatic fever to grow to a 6-foot-4-inch All-American in swimming and track. He had studied desert scorpions at the University of Nebraska and then enlisted in the Navy during the Korean War, where he was promptly assigned responsibility for the disposal of unexploded ordnance left over from World War II. Ultimately, he switched to diesel submarines because he and his wife Irene both thought the job would be safer. He had later thoughts of giving up the filthy, cramped life of a diesel submariner to study medicine, but before he could apply to medical school, Rickover tapped him for the nuclear subforce. Balderston decided that maybe it was a sign, that maybe he was destined to remain on submarines. He believed that, even after all of his illusions of safety were shattered with Scorpion's loss. He had been the engineer officer during her construction, and after her disappearance, accident investigators trying to unravel the mystery frequently called him away from Tautog. On Tautog, Balderston was known as much for his idiosyncrasies as anything else. This man, who could drink any of his crew under the table during port stops, was also something of a health nut. He drank Sanka in lieu of the full-powered brew that kept most of the crew fueled, and he demanded that his sub be stocked with copious supplies of chopped walnuts. He ate them after every meal, save breakfast, because they were full of lecithin. He also had a peculiar dexterity. He could raise his large, gray, bushy eyebrows one at a time, right or left. It didn't seem to matter. Both could make the singular crawl up the side of his face. It was a talent he used for emphasis. When crew members scrambled answers during qualifying exams, an eyebrow would levitate. When a mistake was especially stupid, one of those great brows would leap. One young seaman was especially unnerved by the gesture and could never deliver a message to his commander without stuttering as soon as Balderston sent a brow on its ascent. For the crew, those brows were almost as memorable as the ingenuity Balderston displayed during their first mission together in the summer of 1969, a mission that earned their sub the nickname the Terrible T. They were sent to monitor a test of a new Soviet cruise missile from start to finish. Unlike the Yankees' ballistic missiles, cruise missiles posed little threat to U.S. shores. But these smaller weapons could destroy a massive U.S. aircraft carrier from as far as 250 nautical miles away, and carriers were still one of the primary platforms being used for U.S. bombing missions over Vietnam. Indeed, Echo II submarines, each toting 8 cruise missiles that could hold either nuclear or conventional warheads, had been spotted trailing U.S. aircraft carriers near Southeast Asia. If the Soviets got directly involved in the war there, naval intelligence would need to know as much as possible about the missiles and the subs that carried them. It was Balderston's job to learn how many missiles the Soviets could fire in rapid succession, to capture electronic pulses that might indicate trajectories, and to grab communications that might help to assess weaknesses. He would also try to snap photographs of the launches so analysts back home could measure the flames as the missiles shot skyward, and maybe figure out what type of propellant the Soviets were using. Brazenly, Balderston led his sub through the Soviets' sonar net and right beneath a group of Soviet ships and a submarine, keeping Tautog hidden, hovering at just 70 feet below the surface. Most of the time, the tips of Tautog's intercept antennas and periscope barely broached the waves. The scope's small, cup-shaped eye was so low in the water that every third wave washed over. Balderston took to counting. 1, 2, under. 1, 2, under. 1, 2, under. Perhaps the most critical trick to all of this was keeping the 4,800-ton Tautog level, despite the fact that she was constantly taking on water and getting heavier. Subs take on water in part to cool their reactors, and pumps usually recycle it back to the ocean. But the pumps were too loud to use this mechanism close to the Soviets. Michael J. Coy, one of the diving officers on watch, somehow had to keep Tautog's scope at just the right height without the pumps. It was nerve-wracking business. Coy had been on Tautog for only 3 months, and he knew he was not one of Balderston's favorites. It irked the captain that Coy had enlisted in the sub-force only as an honorable alternative to fighting in Vietnam, just as it irked Coy that Balderston kept talking up the advantages of military life. But now the two of them worked together, as Balderston employed a solution that was ingenious and amazingly low-tech. He called upon an old submariner's trick and ordered all off-duty men out of their bunks, out of the crew's mess, and on a march, first to the forward half of the boat, next to the engine room in the stern. Back and forth they went for hours, living counterweights, keeping Tautog's nose up and the submarine buoyant. There were no breaks for Coy, not even to go to the head. Instead, when it came time to adjust Coy's buoyancy, Balderston sent for an empty coffee can. In the end, Tautog watched the Soviets for 2 days, capturing the entire missile test from start to finish. Balderston brought home so much data that the Navy awarded him one of its highest personal honors, the Legion of Merit. Now in the summer of 1970, as Balderston drove Tautog toward Petropavlovsk, captain and crew were convinced they could do just about anything. One thing high on their list was trailing an Echo II sub. This sort of trail might prove crucial to safeguarding the U.S. carriers off Vietnam, and it was one of the most important roles a sub could play in the war effort. As luck would have it, it was an Echo 2 that registered on Tautog's sonar almost as soon as she reached Soviet waters. There was no mistaking it. Sonar showed the Echo's trademark pair of four-bladed propellers. The sub was moving south from Petropavlovsk, and Tautog's crew had visions of following the sub through an entire patrol. The Echo was noisy and seemed as though she would be an easy target, but no trail was ever really easy. Relying on passive sonar, Tautog's men essentially had little more to interpret than textured static. The muffled whirr buried within that static was their only view of the Soviet sub, and the flickering oscilloscope that transformed some of that static into a light display. It helped that the Soviet commander seemed to be taking no precautions against a hunter. Instead, as Tautog followed behind, he motored noisily, spending 5 hours maneuvering through an odd undersea dance that submariners call angles and dangles. It was almost an undersea Cossack. Submariners on both sides do this awkward dance, a series of random figure eights, sharp turns, and changes in depth, meant to shake things out, to see what kind of noise a submarine is making, and to find out whether anything is stowed where it shouldn't be. The dance has little of the offensive fury of a crazy Ivan, but the steps are tempestuous, and it is impossible to outguess a commander who might order his submarine up or down, right or left, simply as the mood strikes him. The trick to trailing a submarine tripping through angles and dangles is to back off, but aboard Tautog, the order to back off never came. In fact, as the hours passed, the Soviet sub's angles and dangles had begun to seem routine, and Balderston and others left their stations to their seconds in command. The captain went down to his quarters to get some sleep, a marked departure from the past year's missile test mission, where he had stood awake at the helm for nearly 48 hours. On this mission, Tautog had an unusual complement of 2 sonar chiefs instead of 1. But as it turned out, neither of those chiefs was in the sonar shack, while the captain was in his bunk. One of them had been assigned as chief of the watch and was overseeing the enlisted men in the control room. The other was off duty. That left the sonar operation supervised by a more junior man, sonar man First Class David T. Lindsay. Before this mission, Lindsay's biggest claim to fame was accidentally being photographed with Pat Nixon. The First Lady had been visiting wounded Vietnam veterans at a Honolulu military hospital. Lindsay was there because of an accident on his motorcycle, a super souped-up machine that he lovingly called Betsy. When the First Lady came to the submariner, no one had the courage to tell her how he had been hurt. It was a photograph of the two of them that made the local papers. Lindsay had lost an inch off one leg in the accident. And on Tautog, he was dubbed Step and a Half. Now, Step and a Half was listening for the Echo, relaying information to the helm, manned by Tautog's executive officer, who was holding to a track set by the captain. As Tautog cut through the depths of 120 to 200 feet at a moderate 12 to 13 knots, her path was leading her dangerously close to the Echo. Finally, the XO sent for Balderston. Balderston showed up in the control room wearing a dark blue and maroon bathrobe and slippers. He walked directly over to Scott A. Van Hoften, the officer of the deck, who had won minor celebrity among the crew for being the boat's best ship handler and for winning the onboard Coca-Cola consumption record. Now Van Hoften gave the captain a tactical update. Meanwhile, Paul S. Waters, one of the sonar chiefs, returned to the sonar shack, taking over operations there. Putting on a headset, Waters listened for the Soviet Echo. Son of a bitch, it's close, Waters murmured just before he got up to brief the captain. Captain, to the best of my knowledge, this is an Echo 2. It is close aboard. Balderston towered over the short sonar chief, staring at him from beneath those famous eyebrows. As the two men spoke, Balderston settled into a small fold-out seat just behind the periscope stand. With that one move, he took over. He made no dramatic pronouncements. He didn't have to say a word. Van Hoften remained officer of the deck and continued to yell the orders, but everyone knew they came from Balderston. He would not leave the bridge again, not to return to his bunk, not to change out of his bathrobe. At his side was Michael Coy. By now, the all-Navy captain and the decidedly non-military Coy had struck an uneasy peace. Coy had learned to refrain from repeating that he had no intention of staying in the Navy, and Balderston had stopped talking up the advantages of military life. Besides, Coy was also the boat's supply officer, and kept the health-conscious commander in vitamins, Sanka, and enough walnuts to keep his body swimming in lecithin. Balderston began to scrutinize the oscilloscope. On its 9-inch wide screen, a single electronic amber arc offered a sonar-generated image of the Echo. Usually 10 or more faint arcs flickered on the sonar screen, computer depictions of the noise generated by distant boats, land masses, even whales. But the image created by the Soviet sub was large and bright, and it was jumping back and forth across the screen. There was only one interpretation possible. The Echo was very, very close. Here she comes, there she goes, the captain commented, drawing out the sentence to add emphasis to anyone and no one in particular, as he watched the Echo's athletics. He would repeat that comment a few minutes later, and a third time after that. The Echo stood to Balderston's left, studying the navigator's plots. About 5 feet away, Van Hoften bent his 6-foot-5-inch frame over the fire control station, monitoring the weapons computers, which were also tracking the Echo's direction, speed, and distance from Tautog. Just outside the con in the sonar shack, men crowded shoulder to shoulder and continued to track the Echo. Mentally, they sifted the soft, rhythmic shoo-shoo-shoo sounds of the Echo's propellers from the blanket of ocean noise coming through their headsets. But nothing they heard or could see on their display read the Echo's depth. For that, the men could only listen and guess. Every few minutes, the distance between the subs registered zero. At one point, sonar operators guessed that the Echo had risen near the surface, which would have placed her directly above Tautog. Then it seemed that the Echo was descending again. This all could have been made much easier. Tautog had been scheduled to receive a newly engineered device designed to measure another submarine's depth by measuring the disturbances in the water it created. The device consisted of 4 hydrophones, which were supposed to have been mounted on Tautog's sail, but the shipyard had been behind schedule, and the submarine left port with the new technology sitting in Pearl Harbor. One officer muttered that it was too bad about those missing hydrophones, and others began to talk about trying to open up the distance between the two subs. Just then, the image on the oscilloscope leapt again, this time violently. "Here she comes," the captain began. He never finished the sentence. The image on the oscilloscope disappeared. At that instant, the sonar operators lost all track of the Echo. No one knew whether the Echo had gone to the right or to the left. She was just gone. Then the Echo announced herself in the worst possible way. The 6,000-ton sub slammed belly-first into the top of Tautog's sail with an impact that sounded like 2 cars colliding at 40 miles an hour. With a horrible screech, the Echo's propellers ground through Tautog's metal with a din that forced Chief Waters to recoil from his headset. Tautog flipped on her right side, rolling nearly 30 degrees as she was forced backward and down. Men went grabbing for a handhold on rails and tables. Coffee mugs, pencils, rulers, charts, and erasers went flying through the control room. Maraschino cherries and pickle relish splattered all over the mess area. Tools popped out of wall lockers and littered the floor of the engine room. Step and a half Lindsay was thrown down a ladder. Down in the torpedo room, three men who had been sleeping, curled up against the long green weapons, were tossed from their bedpans, those mattresses on top of empty torpedo racks. Around them, the massive weapons strained at their canvas straps. One man jumped up to close the watertight door nearest the torpedo room. He didn't check to see whether anyone was inside, didn't realize that he had just locked in Greg Greeley, an 18-year-old recruit who had boarded Tautog just 3 weeks earlier. All that man knew was that the bow compartment might be among the first to flood, and as the one closest to the hatch, it was his job to seal it off. Then, as he was trained, he turned his back, never looking in the small round window, to see Greeley, frightened, inside. It would be several minutes before anyone could be sure the hull was intact, several minutes before anyone let Greeley out. Meanwhile, other officers jumped out of their bunks, raced out of the wardroom and to the control room, scrambling to assume their pre-assigned collision stations. One man ran frantically back and forth, unsure of what to do. Coy took over the diving station and began struggling to level the sub. Van Hoften gave his last order as officer of the deck, before formally turning the boat over to the captain. "Do not sound the collision alarm." It was awfully late to try to stay quiet and avoid detection, and just as unnecessary to announce the collision. Still, according to Rote, the crew quietly passed a collision alert from man to man, compartment by compartment. Compartment by compartment, the men reported back that each area of Tautog was essentially intact. The watertight doors were opened. "They build them well at Ingalls," Waters finally said, referring to the sub's shipyard in Mississippi. His comment would be caught on an audio tape that was running in the sonar shack, recording the drama. Step and a half hustled back, grabbed hold of a headset, and shouted, "Fuck you, God, nothing gets through HY-80. HY-80 was the steel that Tautog's hull was made of, so named because it could withstand 80,000 pounds of ocean pressure per square inch. Then the two men sat back to listen. What they heard, and what was recorded on the running tape, seemed to confirm the worst. It sounded as if one of the Echo's propellers had been torn off, and with nothing to resist the water, its turbine was spinning wildly. If that were true and the Echo's pressure hull was gashed through, she would likely sink into the ocean. At 2,000 feet down, she would implode. There would be no survivors. Then the men heard noises like an engine starting up and sputtering, followed by banging, perhaps watertight doors being slammed shut on the Echo. Finally, sonar picked up something that sounded like popcorn popping, what Lindsay interpreted as the sound of steel cracking apart. After that, the ocean seemed to go silent, a blanket of uninterrupted static through the sonar men's headsets. They listened for anything that could be the Echo racing away or blowing ballast tanks and surfacing. But everything, the spinning, the banging, the popping, had just stopped. Someone in the sonar shack jumped up and turned off the recorder. The tape normally ran on a continuous loop, and had the recorder been left on, the sounds of the crash would have been lost. Stunned, the operators continued to search, looking for any sign that the Soviet sub had recovered. The silence seemed to mean only one thing, that as many as 90 submariners were helplessly sinking into the crushing depths below. It didn't seem to matter now that they were Soviet submariners. Within minutes of the collision, Balderston gave the order that sent Tautog steaming away, fast. There was no thought of surfacing or even going to periscope depth. This was, in fact, an undersea hit and run. Tautog's crew would not mount a search for survivors or wreckage, normal procedure for a collision at sea. Balderston's prime directive was to avoid any further encounter with the Soviets. Tautog headed due east, moving at only about 12 knots, and listing at least 10 degrees to her starboard side. Every time Balderston tried to drive the submarine faster, she leaned over more sharply. One by one, metal plates that had been welded to Tautog's sail were torn off by the force of the water. Each slammed onto the submarine's hull with a resounding crash. The crew started a pool, betting on how much of the sail would be left when they got back to Pearl Harbor. Water leaked into the control room from the gash left by the Echo's propeller, but it would be hours before Tautog surfaced, hours before a small team of officers could, under the cover of darkness, inspect the damage outside. Men rushed around trying to clean up evidence of the debacle. The sugar bowl looked like it had exploded as the captain and his officers gathered in the wardroom to make sense of what had happened. Scott Ladig, one of Tautog's spooks, greeted the senior officers as they arrived. Ladig was a U.S. Marine. He had been assigned to work with the Naval Security Group, which decided that his fluency in Russian qualified him for submarines. Still, he knew he could offer no help during a collision, so he had done the next best thing. He had gotten out of everyone else's way, slipping down to the wardroom to wait out the adventure.
"I don't know how you guys do this," he said now. "You sit out here in the middle of nowhere, and you let somebody run right through you."
"Gee, I hope we didn't ruin your cup of coffee," Balderston countered. Ladig was a veteran of two tours in Vietnam, and was well known on Tautog for his ability to spin a yarn. Now it seemed as if he and Balderston were conspiring to divert the other officers, at least for a few moments. Balderston asked Ladig whether he'd ever been afraid, really afraid. That was Ladig's cue. He launched into a harrowing tale about the time he had led a platoon after a sniper who had been firing on Americans from across a rice paddy. When the Americans were surprised by a second gunman, Ladig sought the only shelter available, a skinny tree. As he pressed against it, a barrage of bullets sawed his pack off his back. The officers listened, their hands still quaking from the crash. They decided that as bad as their day had been, Ladig had been through worse. He said he wasn't so sure. The men concluded that they were probably all more comfortable dealing with the devil they knew. With that, the officers turned their attention to the devil at hand. For more than 2 hours, they tried to reconstruct the accident and came to a single conclusion. Tautog should have been traveling at a different depth. No one talked about what might have happened to the Soviet sub or her crew. For the first time, Balderston's officers saw him almost humble. At one point, he just shook his head, saying, "You take care of things that need to be taken care of, the safety of the ship, the safety of the crew, and, of course, non-detection." Balderston didn't finish. He didn't have to. His men understood what he meant. Later, he would say what everyone was thinking. Not for several hours, not until Tautog had surfaced and his officers had assessed the damage, not until he was sure his submarine could make it back to Pearl Harbor.
"Well, there goes my career," Balderston finally said. "I can forget about stars."
He had lost his chance to make admiral. When they were 150 to 200 miles away from the Soviet Union, Balderston gave the order to surface. Several officers climbed out the forward hatch into the darkness. They couldn't take the usual route out the sail and up to the bridge. The hatch leading to the bridge had been breached, and the sail flooded. When the officers climbed on deck, they saw that their sail had been dished in one-third of the way back, maybe more. It was almost as if the massive structure had been made of cardboard. A fist-sized chunk of the Echo's propeller was lodged in the tower's upper hatch, which was bent and crammed back into its housing. One of the sub's two periscopes was hopelessly bent. Most of Tau Tog's antenna and electronic masts were jammed inside the damaged sail, and useless. That was going to make it tough to send a message back home, but it was very definitely time to let Pacific Command know what had happened. The crew strung a makeshift antenna, little more than a wire, across the top of the submarine. Then they flashed the bad news. There had been a severe collision. A Soviet submarine was involved, and Tau Tog was ending her operations 2 months early. Commanders on shore flashed back. Tau Tog was to bypass all closer ports and return directly to Pearl Harbor. Later, the instructions would become more detailed. The submarine was to remain away from port until the dead of night. Then she was to creep in, all lights out. On the way back, Balderston ordered the crew to gather in shifts on the mess deck. As if anyone really needed to be reminded, he told them that any discussion of the collision outside of an official inquiry was definitely out. Tau Tog's arrival at Pearl Harbor was logged late on July 1st. She was maneuvered into a shipyard dry dock where a huge shroud was draped over her sail. No one without authorization would be able to see the damage, not even her crew. The men were to be kept aboard for another 24 hours until the damage was well hidden and they had signed formal secrecy oaths. One man tried to hold on to a piece of the Echo's hull as a souvenir, stashing it in a locker on board behind some cleaning fluids and alcohol. Some months later, he was discovered, and security officials insisted that he turn the piece over. Rear Admiral Walter Small, commander of submarines in the Pacific, met Tau Tog at the pier and was among the first to learn the details. Also briefed was Admiral Moore, who was just being promoted from CNO to chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. It was either Moorer or a top Pentagon intelligence official who carried the bad news to Melvin Laird.